Case number 13-1059 et al. Illinois Public Telecommunications Association Petitioner versus Federal Communications Commission et al. Mr. Ward for Petitioners IPTA et al. Mr. Rowland for Petitioner IPANY. Ms. Citrin for Respondents and Mr. Panner for Intervenors.
May it please the Court, I'm Michael Ward, General Counsel for the Illinois Public Telecommunications Association, and I'll be arguing this morning on behalf of all three petitioners. Mr. Rowland, who is the counsel for the New York Association, will have 3 minutes reserved to address a specific issue to New York. The petitioners in this case are trade associations in three states, and they represent hundreds of small businesses who, for the past 17 years, have done everything the Federal Communications Commission asked them to do to implement Section 276 of the Federal Telecommunications Act of 1996. Meanwhile, during the same time period, the Bell operating companies, AT&T and Verizon, have violated the statute, have violated the Commission's rules, regulations, and 8 Commission orders. And the reason we're here today is because of the Commission's failure to enforce the mandates of Section 276.
The statute doesn't speak to refunds in this question, right?
The statute speaks specifically to the prohibitions in 276A are effective as of April 15, 1997, the date of the Commission's orders. Mm-hmm. And in this case, neither the Commission nor the State Commissions, when they initially reviewed our cases, have done anything to enforce the statute or the Commission's rules, regulations, and orders for the time period from the effective date required in the Act, April 15, 1997, for over 6 years in Illinois, 6 years in Ohio, and 9 years in New York. So for that time period, 6 to 9 years, the Act and the federal requirements have been violated, and nothing has been done to enforce them.
Now, so let me ask you a question, excuse me, about the order of actions by the FCC. You're appealing, of course, the refund order. Is that correct? What is called
Yes.
the refund order?
That's correct, Your Honor.
You characterize it a little differently than the order itself. So, I mean, the order left open the refund question. It didn't say that the states had to pay, had to insist on refunds. It left it open. But let me go to the other question. What is the first order that the FCC stated that it would be up to the states to implement the new cost rules?
That was the order on reconsideration in November of 97, or 96.
That's the first one that the states got the authority, right?
That they asked us, right, they directed things to the state first.
You didn't object at that point.
We didn't object to that, Your Honor, because the Commission said that they were retaining jurisdiction, and first of all, they required the states to
follow. Excuse me, insofar as your brief claims this is an illegal delegation to the states, that took place a long time ago and you didn't complain. You're complaining about what the states did with the authority, but insofar as your argument is broader than that, it was forfeited back in the late 90s.
Your Honor, it was not an illegal delegation of the states as designed by the Commission at that time. At that time, the Commission said, we're going to send this initially, and the Commission's orders say initially, to the states for review. The Commission also stated we are specifically retaining jurisdiction and that the states must enforce the orders as we have issued them, and we will make certain that they enforce them or we will take action. Now, in this case, having shown the state did not enforce the orders as implemented and written by the Commission now has not taken any action. As to your point that the refund order does say that refunds are available, that's an interesting point.
It doesn't use the word available, does it?
Yes, it does, Your Honor. It says that they're available back to April 97, where the Bell rates exceeded the
insertion. But it said it was up to the states as to whether it didn't require them to be.
That is the crux of the inconsistency. The commission says they're available, but the three states that are before this court said they're not available in their rulings. They said they're simply not available. It's not that you did something wrong. They're just not available. So, therefore, the states are in direct opposite position to the position the federal commission has now taken. And we have maintained the federal commission's position that the refunds are available from the beginning. In May of 1997, it is stated in the filing at the Illinois Commission that we're asking for refunds to the extent the rates exceed the FCC-required rates. And the commission has now said in this order before the court the refunds are available.
I thought the commission said that refunds are not precluded.
Right.
Isn't that what they said? Isn't that what the FCC said?
That's correct.
And that's a little different.
Well, the Illinois Commission said they are precluded. And the Illinois court said they are precluded.
But a moment ago you said it was a question available. The language was not precluded. That sounds like it's discretionary up to the states.
Well, my recollection, Your Honor, that in the refund order itself, it actually says they are available. They also says they're not precluded. I mean, I don't even know if they use the word precluded. They do say they are available.
I remember, too. You can check it.
But what's the problem, then, to get to the heart of it, I think, with the FCC, given the gap in the statute, and given the initial delegation, as Judge Silverman says, to the states, to leave it to the states to determine the appropriate refunds? What law is violated there?
The states did not enforce the federal law requiring that these rates be effective no later than April 15, 97. And the states went on both federal...
Wasn't there a question, at least until the Wisconsin order in 2004, roughly, if I have the date correct, about how that was going to take place? In other words, since the Wisconsin order, there hasn't been an issue, has there?
Yes, Your Honor. Our decisions were after the Wisconsin order.
Mm-hmm.
The Wisconsin order came...
On a going-forward basis.
Well, the Wisconsin order has been applied back to April 15, 97, including in this refund order. This refund order allows refunds specifically back to April of 97. But our states had already ruled that they were not available, so you have a direct conflict. Mm-hmm. And the commission has not corrected that conflict.
Well, as I looked at the states, there are three states that you're concerned with.
Yes.
Ohio, Illinois, and New York, right?
Correct.
And several of the states, there is a determination made by the commission or the courts in review that your clients, or the ones you're representing here, were derelict in their presentation of their claims.
Actually, Your Honor, the only statement to that effect, which was ruled on by the commission, the Illinois Commission,
yes,
was a statement that the Illinois Association had not filed a complaint. Now, that is
so
totally...
So you think it's up to the FCC to review that, as if it was the court in Illinois determining that was arbitrary and capricious, and therefore we're going to reject it? Is that what your view is?
The record allows no other conclusion. In every Illinois order, including the one that said that, it said we did file a complaint, and the complaint is on file in the record before the FCC. And the Illinois Appellate Court did not say that we hadn't filed a complaint. They corrected that, and then in the comments before the commission, the Illinois Commission no longer said we didn't file a complaint, because it's a ridiculous statement based on the record.
So that's your theory, that the FCC's obligation is to review agency or state court proceedings that are ridiculous. If they're correct, they're okay, but if they're ridiculous, they're reviewable.
Well, even if they're just wrong, they don't have to be ridiculous, Your Honor. And in this case, they're wrong. The record allows no other position than the fact that we did file a complaint in May of 97.
Well, what about the government's argument that these are equitable determinations and there's a good deal of discretion on refund?
This court has already ruled that when there's a violation of the Communications Act for rates that are discriminatory, the remedy for that is under Section 206 of damages to recompense and eliminate the discrimination. The cases cited by the commission are...
Is that the MCI refund case?
That's the MCI case, yes, Your Honor. And I believe it's the 1995. There were many MCI decisions. But it is in our brief. And the cases cited by the commission are 204 cases where we're talking about just and reasonable rates that exceed the rate of return, where there may be other considerations that have offset the problem that have remedied the issue already. That's not the case where you have a direct violation of a statutory prohibition against discrimination, and it has been proven up in an adjudicatory proceeding, which declaratory judgments are, has been ruled upon many times by this court. In that case, it is presumed that the remedy is a retroactive refund of the discriminatory rates. And that's the circumstances that this case finds itself in. This is an adjudicatory proceeding. The remedy is a retroactive application.
Your argument, as I detect more than anything else, is that the filed rate doctrine cannot be applied legally in this situation. That should be your fundamental argument, isn't it?
That's correct, Your Honor. If you look at the refund order itself, it does not find that the filed rate doctrine bars refunds in this case.
No, but it didn't say the reverse either.
The states can't do it because,
the FCC's order didn't say the reverse.
Well, it does.
The filed rate doctrine is illegal here.
It does bond the case, Your Honor, because every one of these rates by the reconsideration order is a tariffed rate. So, therefore, to allow a refund in any state would be a violation of the filed rate doctrine if it was applicable, because every one of them is a refund of a tariffed rate. Most states have given refunds.
Yeah, and so the commission left it to the individual states to determine whether the filed rate doctrine in those states would bar refunds or not.
And under the Supreme Court,
I think that's what's happened. And correct me if I'm wrong on what's happened. That's basically
that is what happened.
And the question really is whether that's that variation in state by state application of the filed rate doctrine. An interesting question: whether that state law there that they're applying, I assume it is somehow arbitrary and capricious or in violation of the statute. I don't see how it's in violation of the statute, given that the statute doesn't say anything.
The statute does say explicitly that this conduct is prohibited after the effective date of the rules. And as we stand here today, this conduct has not been remedied.
The conduct, that doesn't refer to the refund.
Right, the remedy is...
Well, the commission has fashioned no remedy. It's not just that they didn't do refunds, they fashioned no remedy.
I think it's left the remedy issue to the states. And you've won in a lot of states. I mean, not you, because you're only in one. But the in a lot of the states, the providers have won.
But as noted in the DeVell decision and the Tongue Services decision from the other two circuits, that is impermissible under federal law. And I would also note that under the Howlett decision by the Supreme Court, it states explicitly that when a federal cause of action has been established, the elements and the defenses to it are based upon federal law. In this case, the commission's order has based it solely upon state law, and that state law has been preempted. The Section 276C itself.
But the preemption provision says if inconsistent with regulation, and their point, I think, is that the regulation doesn't speak to refunds, so the state application of various doctrines isn't inconsistent with any regulation and therefore is not preempted. I think that's their argument.
I think that's their argument, Your Honor. I think in all...
Actually, it even goes beyond that, if you forgive me for interrupting. I think several of the states were applying what they thought was federal law, too.
Right. In Illinois, they thought they were applying the federal filed rate doctrine, which the commission's order by its own terms does not bar refunds. So, therefore, the federal filed rate doctrine is totally inconsistent with the commission's order. Because you cannot have a refund under the filed rate doctrine, and the commission says you can have refunds. So you have a direct inconsistency.
Can I take you to your dial-around argument? Why do you have standing to make that argument?
Your Honor, in the Lujan...
Who gets the money if there's a disgorgement?
As I understand
it... Does it come to the court? Then I might have a better feeling. Where does it go?
As I understand it, Your Honor, it goes to the U.S. Treasury, but if you want to go to the court, we don't object to that.
Where does it go?
It goes to the U.S. Treasury. It'd be a forfeiture.
So
it does not go back to long distance companies.
Therefore, the standing would be for the United States government, not you.
No, Your Honor. In the case of Lujan, it talks specifically about if a party is complaining about a government's action or inaction to regulate a third party. The fact that it's a third party does not mean that there is no standing. What it means is that they have to show on
which
the...
There are two Lujan cases. Which one are you referring to?
It was the one that was cited in our brief. It was... I can give it to you on the rebuttal.
To figure out why it applies.
The court says it applies because if you can show through the facts that by giving the relief requested is likely to redress the injury, then you still satisfy the standing argument.
What's the injury? Why would the injury be redressed? It's done now.
Because the injury is the overcharging of rates to the
student. But it's too late now. It's not going to have any impact.
Well, it certainly would be remedied if you gave back the money that was overcharged.
Who?
It's not going to you.
It's not going to help you at all.
No, Your Honor, there's a difference between the forfeiture of the dial-around and the refund of the local phone rate overcharges. If their injury is overcharging on the local rate, that's the injury. It was caused by the Bell companies doing the overcharging. And if the
if the Bell companies now have to pay the federal government, how are you helped right now? What impact does that have on you?
If the federal commission would enforce its own order saying that they will not allow
it. If the money is paid now to the federal government, how are you helped?
The FCC's order is they get paid if they don't comply.
I understand. How are you helped if the money is paid now?
The order basically says this. If you don't pay back the $13 million, you forfeit $200 million.
You're not answering the question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I thought that was.
No, I'm still trying to figure out. The timing is wrong. The problem is it's too late now. It doesn't have any impact on you at all.
Under our position, Your Honor, it does have an impact to this extent. We ask that the court remand to the commission to decide
if... You want the box to be punished. Isn't that correct?
No, we want the box to pay back the excess charges.
That's what I meant.
And we want the order from the commission to say if you don't pay back the refunds, you will forfeit the dollar.
Oh, you want to say that. I see.
Exactly. That's exactly what we're trying to say.
Yeah.
In other words, that is the order as stated in the reconsideration order.
Let's hear from Mr. Rowland. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the Court, my name is Keith Rowland. I'm from Albany, New York, and I represent the New York Payphone Association. The purpose of my presentation is to talk about the nature of the relief we need in New York, where it has to be a clear order of preemption. Now, for example, Mr. Ward was asked about the filed rate doctrine. In New York, we have not been allowed refunds, but it's not because of the application of the filed tariff doctrine at all. The New York courts interpreted the FCC's own orders from April 1997 and said, those orders only allow refunds for 45 days. So that's why we in New York are not allowing, well, you can have refunds for 45 days, but it's meaningless, so nothing ever proceeded.
You would say that's a misinterpretation of federal law.
Absolutely.
But that can be appealed up through the New York court system.
A
cert petition to the Supreme Court.
It is a requirement under New York law following in the single unified proceeding that the FCC instructed us to start with at the states, follow our state procedures to implement the new services test requirements, and then, if it doesn't work properly in the states, then we follow in the same proceeding to the FCC because it said it would retain jurisdiction.
Right.
So here, the FCC's order, including the last one that's appealed here, said, yes, you can have refunds. The New York courts have said, no, you can't. We interpret federal law. So now I've got...
The FCC said refunds are not precluded, isn't that?
And Your Honor, they did say, I believe the language is, at one point, they said refunds are available if the state chooses to give them.
That's it. So the state chose against you. So that
that's
not inconsistent with the FCC.
The basis in New York for declining to give refunds was an interpretation of FCC orders from 1997. The last one that just came out said refunds are not precluded. Now that's in direct conflict with the New York Appellate Division decision that says you only get 45 days. So if I have to go back to the New York PSC for further proceedings. When I get there, the New York PSC is going to say, well, did the FCC preempt the New York State Court that said you could only have 45 days? Under this existing FCC order, the New York courts are not preempted. So my Public Service Commission is going to say, I can't do anything here because I have a New York court order that's not preempted that said no refunds, where the FCC has given me the right to go back and get refunds in New York. Not mandated, which is what we would like, but they have said they're available. And when I do go back to New York as part of this refund proceeding, the question is, well, what standard do you apply to decide if the rates are compliant with the FCC standards? The New York courts have said you cannot follow certain FCC orders. The FCC has required other states to apply that very order, the Wisconsin orders from 2000 and 2002. The New York court said, no, you can't look at them. That is totally inconsistent with what the FCC has said is appropriate. In fact, in this order, in the Michigan petition, the FCC did say, go back to the Michigan Commission, and they told the Michigan Commission, reconsider what you've done because it's not compliant with our payphone orders.
I thought you had an exhaustion problem with the New York.
No, sir. That is a complete misreading of what happened. The claim is we're exhausted
who is misreading?
The FCC.
The FCC, and specifically in...
Oh, I thought you meant the court.
No, so sir, I would never say that.
You're saying the FCC misread the New York decisions.
Yes.
What's our standard of review of the FCC on that question?
Well, in my view, it's ab initio because it's a total matter of law. What did the New York court say? And the New York court never said we were precluded from refunds for failure to exhaust administrative remedies. And we pointed this out in the petition and in our pleadings here. What the New York court said was, yes, you properly applied for refunds. We've analyzed the refund claim, and you can only have 45 days of refunds. And they spent a lot of time in the decision saying why we were limited to 45 days. If I had exhausted my administrative remedies on refunds, I wouldn't have bothered to say it's only 45 days.
Well, they said a couple different things, right? They said that. They also pointed out the other avenues of relief that hadn't been pursued. Is that correct?
No. Other item that where this arose was that the initial court that reviewed this in New York said, well, yes, you protested the old Bell Company rates, but you didn't ask the PSC to set a new rate, so you have exhausted administrative remedies with respect to getting a new rate set. Well, that's just not correct, and we have pointed out to the FCC in the record, every New York petition said, please, PSC, set a new rate. And in fact, you have to set a new rate in order to move forward.
Incidentally, there's one question I should ask to both of you, really. Why didn't you employ a 208 procedure and a direct action before the FCC, which was available to you?
It wasn't mandatory. There is a
I know, but it was available. Well, you could have gone directly to the FCC some time ago, both of you.
The FCC told us to first go to the state courts and do the rate hearings.
They didn't tell you not to use a 208 proceeding.
But they originally said, initially, go and have the rate determined at the state level.
In other words, if things were all right at the state, you weren't going to...
That's correct. So
you had a federal remedy. You could have gone directly to the FCC. Now, to be sure, although the government makes that point in the brief, it doesn't appear in the FCC's decision, so I'm not sure if we can rely on it. But I was curious why you didn't do it.
Well, it was an alternative. And because we had to go to the state for the rate-making hearing, then we followed the standard procedure going through the state rate-making. And when those decisions were issued, you would follow it through the state courts.
Just out of curiosity, how much money is at stake in New York?
It could be $30 million, $40 million.
On the refunds alone?
On refunds. This goes back to 1997. And there was a lot of money. We had new rates set in 2006.
It's worth litigating.
So, yes, sir. Worth litigating. Yeah.
Thank you.
Thank you.
What about the 208 point? Weren't you illegitimate in raising that in your brief when it wasn't in the FCC's order?
I don't think so, Your Honor. It is mentioned in the order in paragraph 6.
Oh.
We cite the availability of that remedy, and I think note 23 or 28.
It was a note, huh?
It was a note.
I missed it.
If I may take a step back, I think the court is focused on the central issue here, which is the reasonableness of the FCC's decision to that state authorities in these cases were better positioned than the FCC to decide the refund disputes. And I'd like to give...
Would states applying state substantive law?
The states...
Is that what the FCC contemplated? You use the phrase procedural rules many times in the brief, and it just struck me that the filed rate doctrine is not a... It's more of a substantive than a procedure. I'm not sure that matters, but your consistent emphasis on procedural raised a yellow flag for me.
I think you're right, Your Honor, that it isn't limited necessarily to procedural rules. The states would be applying the state filed rate doctrine. It has some procedural elements. It might not be a procedural rule.
Excuse me, counsel. They're also applying federal law, too, which makes it sort of interesting.
That's correct, Your Honor, and it is an interesting framework, but
And the commission was okay. I'm sorry to interrupt, but the commission would be okay with, say, state legislature in one state saying, passing a law saying refunds are permissible in this case, and the state legislature in a different state saying refunds are not permissible in this situation. Would that be okay?
No, Your Honor. To the extent you're suggesting that the logic of the order would permit a state to put in place a rule that would say, per se, under Section 276, there are no refunds, I don't think the order goes that far. What the order does say is that the Commission's interpretation of Section 276 is that it doesn't require refunds in every case. There may be cases, because of the equitable nature of the refund remedy, where refunds are appropriate and some where they're not.
Is that a federal law question or a state law question? I'm not sure it matters, but I'm just curious what
the interpretation of Section 276 is a question
law,
of federal law.
But then the determination whether to give the refund, so there's a gap in the statute,
that's
let's say,
right.
And then the FCC doesn't really fill the gap. It says we're going to let the states decide, correct me if I'm wrong, the states decide whether to issue refunds. Right. And when the state makes that decision, there's no federal law really to apply. I mean, maybe it's filling the gaps itself in federal law, and that's a federal lawmaking. Again, I'm not sure this matters, but I was curious.
I think it flows from – I think it's possible that there could be a state – for example, in the Michigan case, as I understand it, that they've cited in their 28J letter, there was – the state was applying a state regulation and a remedial rule of the state that was more protective, perhaps, than Section 276. I think the logic of the order does permit that. Mm-hmm. We're not attempting to draw some stark procedural substantive line. Okay. What
suppose
the order,
a state of Ames, X, state X, said, well, the FCC requires this new basis of cost calculation in order to prevent discrimination, and we will impose that, but we're never going to order any refunds, so don't worry about it.
Under the order in the future, it should a state say that? It hasn't happened, and the petitioners in all the cases that have litigated this issue, there's not been a case they've pointed to that has done this, but should that happen tomorrow, Judge Silberman, I think under the logic of the order, the FCC could correct a statement that said, under federal law, we're not going to, we don't recognize that a refund is ever available.
No, I'm going to do it as a matter of state law. No refunds.
And as a matter of state law, that would, if to the extent that that was inconsistent with federal law, Section 276, nothing in the order forecloses the FCC from correcting a decision of that nature. And similarly, if, for example, states...
So the question is whether or not you are obliged to intervene, would depend on how defiant the state was.
It would depend on whether...
Isn't that in the answer, yes? If the state... Does that to the federal government? You're obliged to intervene?
If a state says this and it's consistent with... If it's consistent with federal law, then...
You're obliged to intervene at that point.
If it's inconsistent with federal law, under Section 276C, the FCC, under this order, could correct those decisions. If you encountered a situation where states were
So does that mean you are obliged to consider whether the three states involved were acting in good faith or not?
I don't think so, Your Honor, because...
Well, but you just agreed that if the state was in absolute defiance, nominally requiring the new cost-based method of avoiding discrimination, but refusing ever to insist on refunds even if there's non-compliance,
I should perhaps be drawing a better distinction in my response between just absolute defiance, which in the context of this order, it is true that the FCC is not going to correct incorrect state decisions to the extent that they're consistent with the FCC's interpretation of 276 in the payphone orders. If there were a rash of states that were that it developed were being unreasonable in that way,
so
the FCC could reconsider
counsel,
the
would
order.
Would you agree with counsel if one of the states behaved in a ridiculous fashion, you're obliged to take action?
I don't think we're obliged, except
to... You don't think we're obliged even if the state is ridiculous?
Even if the state is ridiculous, I think the logic of the order tolerates that result, and the reason is that...
In other words, a stupid application is okay, but a defiant one is not.
A stupid or a defiant application, Your Honor, is okay, but an application that is inconsistent with the FCC's interpretation of 276 and the payphone orders would be different. I think it's important to recognize that in the context of this order, and that's what's before the court for review, there were many proceedings, and the FCC looked at them, and it wasn't a case where...
In those circumstances, they could bring a 208 complaint, right, if the state was just being defiant? How would that work?
The 208 remedy was always at all times available to these petitioners and parties similarly situated.
Yeah, that provides a direct suit from on the part of the payphone people against the box.
That's right.
That's what it is. And in which case, the FCC sits as an adjudicator.
That's right.
But if the state were being defiant, that was my hypothetical. If the state's being defiant, that's one tool that's out there, correct?
That would be a tool, Your Honor.
Okay.
And
there's one other argument you make in the brief, or was it you made the brief? State decisions are preclusion. We're precluding us from the res judicata.
That's an argument the interveners raised.
Yes, the interveners get a chance to come in.
Yes.
Okay.
Can I ask a question about A20? It's page 20 of the appendix. It's the refund order, and the FCC says that the commission made clear that NST compliant rates were a quid pro quo for receiving dial around compensation when they're talking about the Bell operating.
Right.
Quid pro quo. Now, the commission also said in probably five different orders at least that in order for the Bell operating companies to obtain this dial-around compensation, they had to have NST-compliant rates to be eligible, and they said eligible every time. So if the state makes a finding that the Bell operating companies did not have NST-compliant rates, then they are not eligible to receive. That's tantamount to a finding that they were not eligible to receive the dial-around compensation. So how can they keep the quid if they didn't do the quo, so to speak? So why isn't it proper, if they want to be able to keep the quid, that they can't, you know, they've got to give the refunds, because the refunds... The NST compliant rates were the quid for the quo, so to speak.
I understand the logic of your question, and that it might have been reasonable to award refunds. The FCC could reasonably have done that, but I think nothing in the statute, which is an ambiguous statute, silent on refunds, requires, in a situation where the state commissions were closest to the facts relevant to an equitable determination of refunds, for the FCC to step in and make that
decision. But the statute required NST-compliant rates before they were eligible to get the dial-around compensation. So that was required by the statute.
I'm not sure that the quid pro quo language, Your Honor, stems from the statute. The FCC put in place a regulation that the Bell operating companies should be in a position to certify their compliance before they began collecting dial-around compensation. I don't think anything in the language of the statute requires refunds merely because the...
Yeah, I'm not saying that the statute requires refunds, but the statute required their rates to be compliant for them to be eligible to get this compensation. And the commission is the entity that, in interpreting all of this, said that, well, this is a quid pro quo.
The statute required the commission to do two things. It required the commission to put in place safeguards, the new services test to ensure non-subsidization, non-discrimination, and it also required, in part for the benefit of the Bell operating companies and their payphone services, but for all payphone service providers, to put in place a dial-around compensation scheme that would allow fair compensation for each and every call. I don't think Congress anywhere in the statute said that if once you begin collecting dial-around compensation as part of this quid pro quo, Congress didn't put in place the quid pro quo. It's not a quid pro quo under the statute. The FCC did, you're correct, recognize that linking these might encourage compliance with the new services test, but I don't think the logic of that is to require refunds in this situation.
Well, let's also just factually, I want to make sure that I understand something. If you have like a Verizon Bell operating company that owns that's a payphone provider, okay, prior to the 1996 Act, if someone came to their payphone with a Sprint calling card and made a long-distance call using their Sprint calling card, Verizon would not be able to obtain the dial-round compensation, right?
That's correct.
So they wouldn't make any money on that call, right?
That's right.
After the 96 Act, Verizon can make money on that call because they can receive the dial-around compensation from Sprint, right?
Right.
So after the 96 Act, the fact that they get this, that they're able to obtain this dial-around compensation, allows them to better compete with the independent PSPs who can collect, who could already have collected the dial-around compensation, right? Isn't that another reason why looking at the NST compliant tariffs should be a quid pro quo, because they're getting another revenue source out of this deal?
Your Honor,
it's a major revenue source, hundreds of millions of dollars, right?
I think it is. I think it's consistent with the order to say that that is a consideration, that one of many considerations that could bear on the question of whether refunds are warranted. But the real, the reason that the FCC's decision to leave these decisions in the hands of the states was reasonable is that there are many factors unique to a particular case that come into play in that decision. And here, where everyone agrees that the states lawfully conducted the underlying pricing proceeding, as a function of that, states were closer to the relevant facts, and it was reasonable for the FCC to determine that the state commissions, with avenues of state review, Judge Kavanaugh, as you pointed out, were better positioned if petitioners didn't pursue the federal avenue of a 208 complaint.
And your position is that had the FCC adopted the position from the dissenting commissioner, it had discretion to do that, but it had discretion not to do that as well under the statute, right?
Yes, Your Honor.
So if, okay, it's not that the commission disagreed legally with the statement of the dissenting commissioner, but rather it was disagreed in how to exercise the discretion under the statute.
That's
under this question.
That's correct.
Okay, thank you. Hear from the intervener.
Thank you, Judge Kavanaugh. May it please the Court. I think the place to start is actually a question that came early in Mr. Ward's argument with regard to when the Commission made the decision that these sorts of determinations would be the responsibility of the states. And that was back in the 96 order on reconsideration, where the FCC said, we are going to rely on the states who have been tariffing payphone lines for many years to continue to do this pursuant to a federal pricing standard. And that was the limit of what the FCC did in terms of preempting state authority over payphone line rates. And a natural outgrowth of that was the understanding that there were going to be state procedures and state remedies in circumstances where there were disputes over compliance with that federal standard. And that's exactly what happened in these cases, is that there was a federal forum available, there was a state forum available for vindication of federal rights. Those federal arguments were pressed before those state commissions. Some of those state commission proceedings took a long time, and that specifically recognized in the Illinois Commission decision, for example, that part of the reason it took such a long time was that the Illinois Association did not, I think, pull a particularly diligent oar, was the phrase that the Commission used in the order. And in the New York case, there was no request for a refund at all until late 1999. So these were state proceedings that went along. They resulted in the putting in place of rates that everyone agrees are compliant with federal requirements. There was a state forum available in which all federal arguments could be pressed with respect to the availability of refunds, and that's exactly what
happened. Do you think the states are applying state law or federal law when they determine whether refunds are available?
I think they were really applying state law, Your Honor, because what's going on there is that there's the scope of preemption is that there is a federal pricing standard that the states need to apply in their state tariff proceedings, and I think I may be the guilty party for emphasizing the idea that this is that the filed rate doctrine here is a procedural bar, and I'd like to just take a second to say why I think that's an accurate characterization in this circumstance, which is that.
Before you do that,
yes, Your Honor,
I think the states are operating under the principle that state law applied within a framework of federal law.
Certainly, what's going on is that there's a federal regulatory scheme in which there's a reliance on the availability of this state procedure to ensure that the federal rules are implemented. But the reason that I say that the availability of that remedy is a question.
I think you're correct. I think that the way you just stated it, I think that is correct.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just to say why I think it is a procedural issue is that there are a number of different procedures that could be pursued within those state tariff proceedings, as they could be in an analogous circumstance if it were a rate-making proceeding at the FCC. And so the availability of particular remedies, including, for example, refunds, would depend on the particular proceedings that were pursued. And it was entirely appropriate for the states to, given the manner in which the FCC chose to implement that particular requirement that they adopt regulations, they did so. And the states gave an appropriate forum for the payphone providers to pursue a remedy for rates that they thought were too high. Rates were put in place that everyone agrees are lawful. And then there was an opportunity to dispute the refund issue in state court pursuing all federal.
Well, counsel, what the argument you make is the effect that we should give judicial deference, res judicata, basically, to the state court determination struck me as a particularly weak part of your brief, since we're reviewing, and tell me where I'm wrong, we're reviewing the FCC's reasonableness in its position. We're not reviewing the state court determinations.
Well, Your Honor, I think the reason why I think there's res judicata in this circumstance is that the FCC did not grant the relief that was sought.
The FCC could they not have issued an order saying New York, Illinois, and Ohio are in defiance, and we thereby determine that we change our mind and refunds are necessary.
Well, Your Honor, I don't want to take up the court's time, but I don't agree with that.
Why?
Because
you're not taking up the court's time when you're answering the question.
well said, Your Honor, and I apologize. All I meant to say was that I think that the FCC's order is quite sustainable on the merits. But with respect to what the FCC could have done, the point is that
the FCC could have rejected the state court proceedings.
As a matter of federal common law, I don't believe they could have. Because
as a matter of federal common law, which the FCC doesn't do federal common law.
No, Your Honor. The federal common law would have bound the FCC to give res judicata issue preclusive effect to that prior state court judgment. I can take a minute to try to explain why.
No, I think you better just go on. I think you're right. You don't want to take the court's time.
I anticipated your feeling about it.
Yes. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Your Honor, as to your questions regarding the Section 208 complaint, whether the payphone providers could have filed that, in the context of this proceeding and the FCC's actual practice, the short answer is no. And you will see in the briefs we point out in this context about whether you have to first establish are the rates in excess of the cost-based rate requirement. That has to be established first. Any attempt to proceed without that, the FCC would not proceed. The FCC ruled repeatedly that to get that determination, you had to first go back to the state commissions and get that ruling. Now, North Carolina had submitted the actual information as to their rates, the backup information, to the FCC. And when the North Carolina Commission decided that it would review that, the FCC sent that all back to North Carolina, saying if the state commission will review it, we won't. In the Wisconsin case, the same thing happened. The information was submitted to the FCC. And the FCC said, well, and then Wisconsin changed its position, says, we'll look at it. And despite the payphone provider's request for the FCC to make the determination and look at it, they said, we won't as long as your state commission is willing to. On reconsideration again, they asked them again to do it, and again they said no. So the context is the FCC repeatedly would not accept an independent action at the FCC in those states where the state commission was willing to do the cost analysis. So we were required to go to the state and get the state to do
Did
that.
Did anybody try a 208 proceeding?
No, Your Honor, because the practice then followed by...
So nobody tried a 208 proceeding.
No, what we did is we followed the procedure the FCC laid out, which was declaratory judgment review. The FCC said... The FCC said in the Second Bureau Waiver Order, in the Wisconsin Bureau Order, and in the Wisconsin Commission Order, they specifically said that they were sending it to the states and retaining jurisdiction to review those state proceedings. So what we did is just what the FCC told us to do, take it to the state and then can bring it back. And what the practice they followed was to review this on declaratory judgments, which is exactly the process we followed here. So we did what we were told to do. And now for the commission, actually the commission didn't say we had to file 208. If you look at the order, it just mentions the fact that it exists. And for the commission now to argue that we should have followed 208 13 or 17 years after the fact.
No, they should have. They said that was an option that you didn't use.
And what my point is, Your Honor, respectfully, is under the practice filed by the FCC, it was not an option. We were not allowed to go directly to the FCC. We had to get the state ruling. And then we had the state ruling review. And that's the practice the FCC filed. They did it in the North Carolina case and twice in the Michigan case.
How did things evolve then in the TON case out of Utah?
In that case...
Quest, right?
Yes, Your Honor. That was Quest. In that case, the proponents there, the payphone providers out in that case, did not initiate proceedings in the state commission. What they did is years down the road, which is like 5 years after we filed our complaint in the state proceeding, they went directly to the federal court. And the federal court ruled that it rejected this concept that the state or federal filed rate document would bar refunds if they were able to prove the rates were excessive. In that decision, in fact, I think it was the DeBell decision, which is a companion case in another circuit, the court noted in its footnote, to determine, though, if there actually is a violation of the Act, in other words, if the rates exceeded the new services test requirement, it would probably have to go back to a state commission to make that determination because that's where the commission said it had to be.
And so they relied on primary jurisdiction to send it back to the commission.
It actually never got that far. After they ruled that the refunds were not barred, that case, I'm sorry, it did go back to the FCC. But the appellate court, the Circuit Court of Appeals, noted that if the FCC agreed with them, that the refunds cannot be barred, actually cannot be barred by the filed rate doctrine. But then it would come back and it would still have to go to a commission to get this determination. So the whole time, we followed the practice that the FCC laid out and, in fact, followed. So there might have been other violations of Section 276 where 208 would have been appropriate, but had we just come in and filed a 208 complaint, we would have gotten the same ruling that the commission had ruled many times, as no, you have to first go to your state commission, and we will review that.
There's a rather famous case where AT&T sued MCI in a 208 proceeding to essentially challenge the FCC's position. And when the FCC refused to rule for AT&T, they brought it up to this court and won based on a 208 proceeding. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. I'm surprised how pliant you were vis-a-vis the FCC.
I didn't realize I was that pliant, Your Honor.
You just said, we didn't want to use 208 because the FCC didn't want us to.
Well, we didn't want to use 208 because the FCC would have thrown us out.
Well, you don't know that.
Well, now that I know the FCC is not following its orders, I would agree with Your Honor. But the orders we had at the time, that's how they proceeded.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Case is submitted.